From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Enron was America's seventh biggest company in the year 2000, and by the year 2001, it became the biggest bankruptcy in history. And many are wondering if it will be the political albatross of the 2002 election season. No fewer than 10 congressional committees are looking into possible malfeasance around the Enron collapse, and their investigations are driving this story forward. From the top on down, the Bush administration was very friendly with Enron executives, and dozens of members of Congress were beneficiaries of Enron donations. That's why it was so surprising when Howard Mortman, a columnist for the National Journal's Hotline newsletter, went to a meeting of political journalists. The consensus was that Enron, though a financial fiasco, didn't qualify as a political scandal. Howard Mortman, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
So why isn't it a political scandal? Because no politician is accused of a crime?
I think because that it hasn't met any of the standard definitions of a political scandal. You know, no indictments or grand jury investigations of politicians. Well, we have definitely a big political mess here for both parties. But in terms of our traditional knowledge of or understanding what a scandal is, this really hasn't met the test yet in the minds of the media.
So do you think the Washington Press Corps will just walk away from the country's seventh largest company turning belly up if it doesn't take down any members of Congress or the administration with it?
I think that the Washington Press Corps smells blood in the water for both parties when you have current Republican officials and former Democratic officials both heavily involved with Enron. There is no heavy political axe to grind. Let's say the Bush administration turns over documents that shows undue influence from Kenneth Lay, the CEO of Enron, in drafting energy policy, for instance. Is that a scandal, or is that just the way government works and the way politics and government interplay?
I guess what you're telling me is that since the money flow was so bipartisan and so much part of the fabric of life in Washington, D.C., there's nothing to get excited about.
It doesn't really matter that the money flow went to both parties. It can go to a single party. Enron could have given millions of dollars solely to the Republicans and $0 to the Democrats. That's still not a scandal. That is still not illegal.
What about the sense that is abroad in the land that the entire political structure of the country is awash in money that's corrupting the system? I mean, that's the Enron story, isn't it?
Let me bring up an example of a news director I talked to from a station in Iowa, and I'm very interested in what a Des Moines TV station is thinking, because Des Moines in Iowa is the first level of the campaign 2004, the presidential caucuses. So I asked the Iowa news director, if you had a Democratic presidential candidate coming to Iowa in the next couple of weeks or so, what would be the top three questions you would ask that candidate? And this news director from Iowa said, first of all, how has President Bush been doing since September 11th and handling matters? The second question this Iowa news director would ask of a Democratic candidate would be the economy and taxes, and what should we be doing to get us out of recession? And the third question is a very Iowa question, agriculture. I asked him, well, you know, you didn't mention Enron. And he said Enron is a very big story, a very important story, but it's not yet a political story that I would ask a Democratic candidate.
So is it a failing of the press or the public that without a smoking gun, there's no scandal? In other words, a blue dress is a smoking gun, therefore a scandal. But a systemic legalized process of buying access is par for the course, therefore no scandal. What does it take to get the public up in arms?
Well, what it doesn't take is reviewing quarterly reports. There's more excitement in a blue dress than there are in reviewing quarterly statements from companies. Now, what would get people impressed? Well, shredding of documents is always a sexy thing to talk about. You know, members of the Enron board testifying, raising their right arm like tobacco industry did, that would get people in an uproar. What the story lacks is, I hate saying it, is lacks sex. That's not as exciting as a sexy story was to the Washington Press Corps.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Brooke.
Howard Mortman is a senior columnist for the National Journal's Hotline, a political newsletter based in Washington, D.C.
With the Enron story gaining momentum, a lot of politicians will be looking for cover, any kind of cover. Kevin Guilfoyle has a strategy for managing the media, and he's giving it away for free.
In 1997, Oscar winner Dustin Hoffman and director Barry Levinson made a motion picture called Wag the Dog, which they hoped would distract the American public from the embarrassing fact that they were also making a movie called Sphere with Sharon Stone. The ruse worked, and the phrase wagging the dog has entered the vernacular to describe a political strategy in which a president uses military action to distract voters from a domestic scandal. As it turns out, the dog waggers have it all backwards. You don't distract the American people with a noisy war. You do it with a story so absurdly irrelevant that it's guaranteed to occupy every late-night monologue for weeks, even as America's seventh-largest company implodes all over Congress and the administration. Let's call the new strategy choking the pretzel. First, let me say that I don't know if there's an actual scandal brewing at the White House. But if the Enron affair does reach all the way to the West Wing, this new pretzel tactic is brilliant. And history will show that the pretzel wasn't choking President Bush. President Bush was choking the pretzel. Imagine in 1972 if the White House had responded to the Washington Post's Watergate allegations by calling a press conference to announce that President Nixon had stuck a Cheerio up his nose. Bob and Carl, nice story, but you've been bumped to page B7. In January of 1998, when Bill Clinton made the speech that will forever haunt his legacy, he should have worn an eye patch. A black one, like a pirate. I poked myself in the eye with a pixie stick, he should have said. Also, I did not have sex with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. After that, who cares about Monica? The president blinded himself. With candy. That's hilarious. We don't care at all for a politician who's been humiliated, but we love a politician who's been slightly embarrassed. Conceal the skeleton in the closet behind mild discomfiture, and the non-story will drown out the real story every time. I end with my bipartisan choking the pretzel assignments to the current crop of presidential hopefuls, in case one of them needs to save his career someday by acting like a total spaz. Tom Daschle, moon pie in the auditory canal. John McCain, allergic to his own gums. Joe Lieberman, slipped on pudding. Trent Lott, drinking a glass of Mountain Dew that turns out not to be Mountain Dew. And Al Sharpton? Well, Reverend, you're way ahead of me.
Kevin Guilfoyle is the co-author of My First Presidentiary, a scrapbook by George W. Bush, published by Modern Humorist and Three Rivers Press. Opponents of media concentration were staggered late last week by news from the Federal Trade Commission that it might soon be ceding oversight of media mergers to antitrust specialists in the U.S. Department of Justice. The plan was due to be announced at a news conference Thursday, but last-minute protests from Capitol Hill have stalled the process for now. The FTC has been seen as the most consumer-friendly government watchdog on these matters. Now such proposed mergers as the AT&T Comcast cable systems deal will be scrutinized by political appointees in the Bush administration's Justice Department and by Michael Powell's Federal Communications Commission, both ideologically predisposed to more concentration, not less. Joining us now is Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy in Washington. Jeff, why is the FTC preferable to the Justice Department when it comes to the media merger issue?
Only the FTC has shown recently that it fully understands the impact that these big media conglomerates might have on the internet, on competition, on programming. And so, for example, when the FTC reviewed the merger last year of AOL Time Warner, it developed a series of safeguards that neither the Justice Department nor the Federal Communications Commission would have likely enacted. So the FTC has simply been the stronger watchdog. The FTC is an independent agency. There are five commissioners with different political backgrounds, and they're much more receptive to the concerns of consumers and small and medium-sized businesses. At the Department of Justice, it's sort of one-stop shopping. You see the key presidential appointee. They look at these mergers in a very narrow way. They're much more susceptible to political influence than the Federal Trade Commission.
So for an independent watchdog organization like the Center for Digital Democracy and other groups like yours, this is a bombshell.
This was clearly an attempt, I think, by the Bush administration to remove the only government agency that might create some safeguards to restrain the power of these big media conglomerates. I think the Bush administration and some of the media companies understood that in the review of the AT&T Comcast merger coming up, for example, consumer groups would have found a much more receptive place at the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC understood what would be at stake. Certainly, we would not be able to obtain that same kind of regulatory rigor at the Department of Justice.
Jeff, AT&T and Comcast, what's at stake?
This merge powerhouse will dominate what we see on television and how we receive information online. If the Bush plan goes through and the Federal Trade Commission no longer has a role on media mergers, then indeed AT&T Comcast will simply go through approved without any kind of restrictions or safeguard. And I don't think it's a coincidence, frankly, that this decision is coming down before the merger is reviewed. I think that AT&T and Comcast and others understood that consumer groups and others would have access at the Federal Trade Commission, that the FTC had that experience in AOL Time Warner, so it understood what it was at stake. By removing the Federal Trade Commission from this regulatory process, the Bush administration has assured AT&T and Comcast that their merger will go through unimpeded.
All of your hopes rest with the Congress at this point, I gather.
Yes. If the Congress doesn't insist that the status quo remain, then we will be able to do absolutely nothing in the merger of Comcast and AT&T.
All right, Jeff. You have been Chicken Little for some good while now. Has the sky fallen in?
I think the sky's about to hit the ground. The Bush administration is dismantling decades-old rules that have restrained the size of these media giants. They're about to declare a policy that would, in essence, say the Internet doesn't have to be run as an open network anymore. So a handful of giants, really two, AOL Time Warner and AT&T Comcast with Microsoft as its partner, will be dominating much of what we see and hear. And it looks like the public will have very little recourse unless we can put some teeth back in the antitrust process.
All right. Jeff Chester, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Jeff Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy.
Coming up, appealing to bilingual youth, and when is a POW not a POW?
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the small screen became a little less gringo, but maybe a little more American. On Tuesday, the Spanish-language television giant Univision spun off a new TV network. It's called Telefutura, and it's predicted to be profitable within a year, despite the recent slump in the advertising business. As Raquel Maria Dillon reports, the new network hopes to draw the elusive younger Latino, Generation N.
In San Francisco, the launch party for Telefutura's local affiliate was packed as station employees and Latino business leaders counted down to the debut of the new station. Univision already owns a cable network, a popular website, a music label, and a successful TV network that's watched by over 80% of Spanish-speaking households in the U.S. Its main competitor, Telemundo, was recently bought by NBC. According to Marcela Medina, general manager of Telefutura's Bay Area affiliate, the new network is designed to appeal to the 20% of Spanish speakers that don't watch Univision.
We reach out to that younger Latino. It's the bilingual person that may be tuning and watching some English language television with movies, with videos, with this new look, and frankly, with an appeal that is definitely decidedly young and fresh.
According to the 2000 U.S. Census, Hispanics make up 13% of the U.S. population. A steady stream of new immigrants guarantee that Spanish-language TV is a growth market. Univision fills their need for news and telenovelas, but it misses the mark with younger bilingual Latinos. Carlos Santiago is a San Francisco marketing consultant.
Young Hispanics make about one-fifth of all young Americans. And in cities, in the major cities of the U.S., they make over 45% of all young people.
Like their African-American peers, young Latinos are early adopters of cultural trends. They're also bilingual and bicultural, but they think Spanish TV is for their parents.
It's like watching 1950s American TV in Spanish, and they would rather see themselves viewing English programming than the same novella five nights a week and not much difference in plot between one and the next.
Unlike Univision, Telefutura's program schedule features daily sports news, focusing on boxing and soccer, and performances of Latin pop stars. Edwin Garcia writes a media column for Nuevo Mundo, a Bay Area Spanish language weekly. At home, he has over 200 cable channels, and 10 are in Spanish.
I'm a news junkie, and I've always watched Spanish language TV in this market or anywhere else. I like to compare.
So far, Garcia is not impressed by what Telefutura has to offer. He says that a corporation as large and powerful as Univision should provide more than just entertainment.
I'm disappointed that there isn't news or much local programming. That's what I was looking forward to. But it's too bad because that's one area they could do a lot of good out there in society is informing the Latino public about news and current events.
And what really bugs him about Spanish language TV is the fuzzy line between information and entertainment programming and the women in skimpy clothing on prime time. He expects Telefutura will be more of the same.
Women hosts with their own calendars, their own swimsuit calendars. I mean, imagine Katie Couric in a bikini or half naked. You're not going to see it. But you will see it with some of these celebrities that Univision has been creating.
Spanish language TV, it's like a time machine, you know. You can see the beginnings of how TV started.
Lalo López Alcaraz draws a syndicated political cartoon, writes satire, and runs a website called Pocho.com. In Mexican Spanish, Pocho refers to a Latino who's grown up in the U.S. and acts more American than Mexican, but Alcaraz uses the term with pride. He says Telefutura is just Univision with a different name, regurgitating the same old programs borrowed from Latin America, and those shows don't speak to pochos like him.
You don't see yourself reflected in any sort of, you know, way in, on in the media. I guess everybody likes to think that they're one of the friends, but there's no amigos on Friends.
In San Francisco's Mission District, at a record store called Ritmo Latino, the 20-somethings browsing through CD racks prefer to speak Spanish, but they watch their TV in English, Cops, reality shows, and Dawson's Creek. And like the critics, Iván Velázquez expects more from TV in Español. He says he's glad Telefutura will air Hollywood movies dubbed into Spanish and World Cup soccer matches. But what he'd really like to watch in Spanish is the Discovery Channel. For On the Media, I'm Raquel Maria Dillon in San Francisco.
The people who brought us the Got Milk campaign are now aiming their udders at Hispanic youth. The California Milk Processor Board asked four advertising students to come up with some culturally resonant pitches. The winning campaign makes prominent use of a boogeyman, or boogeywoman, that Spanish-speaking parents have long used to get kids to do stuff they don't want to. More on that in a moment. Now we're joined by Jeff Manning, the executive director of the California Milk Processor Board. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. And David Delgado is a student at the Art Center College of Design, majoring in advertising. Welcome to you too, David.
Thank you very much.
You must know this ad very well. Would you just describe what's happening?
It begins with La Llorona walking down a hallway, and it's a beautiful ghostly figure. Walks through a couple's room. They're asleep. He had just fallen asleep reading the legend of La Llorona. She walks into the kitchen through a wall, and she looks at the refrigerator, and I believe at this point she opens it up and sees the milk.
Leche.
It turns out the milk is empty, and she begins crying again.
Got milk.
And walks out of the room.
Okay. La Llorona is a mythical Latina ghost of a mother now roaming the earth in tears after murdering her children and killing herself. So, David Delgado, is she the best spokeswoman for milk?
Well, we thought it's been around for so long, it's not something that's that scary anymore. we wanted to create something that would communicate to Latino teens. It's kind of a marker of what's happening in especially California. I mean, Latino Americans are mainstream, and I don't think there should be any reason why you couldn't have that same content on network TV.
Okay, well, at test screenings, Anglo kids were puzzled by this ad, while Latinos were happy to see part of their culture on television. Does this suggest that you're willing to confuse most of your audience to grab the attention of at least one part?
Yes, I mean, there's some mystery here. What was wonderful in the same focus groups, the non-Spanish-speaking kids would turn to the Hispanics in the room and say, what was that about? And they would say, oh, it's La Llorona. Let me explain it to you. That's pretty magical when that happens.
So, Jeff, you got about 24 proposals from the four advertising mm-hmm. majors. David, were there any legends that you rejected?
We're actually telling another story. This was the Chupacabra. The Chupacabra is almost like a vampire who entered a grocery store and caught a grocery store clerk off guard and went in the back to take a break and was drinking some milk. And as he reached to grab one of the cartons of milk, he got pulled from the other side by the Chupacabra and was thrown on the ground, and the milk was tossed back out to him with two fang holes punctured through the milk carton.
And you just didn't think the milk-sucking vampire would probably sell as much milk.
No, that one got the reject.
Well, thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
Thank you.
Jeff Manning is the executive director of the California Milk Processing Board, and David Delgado is a student at the Art Center College of Design, majoring in advertising.
As the fighting in Afghanistan winds down and the war on terrorism moves elsewhere, the world press, which has so vacillated about the long arm of American influence, seems to be changing its mind again. Joining us now once again is Martin Walker, chief correspondent of United Press International. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Hello again.
It truly seems that one moment America can do no right, and then the next week America can do no wrong. Is it that the European press is just calling them as they see them, or is there some sort of deeper struggle to find out where Europe fits in what is increasingly U.S. hegemony around the world?
Well, bear in mind that editorial writers and columnists in newspapers have got the burden of having to write something different every day. So I'm not surprised they zigzag a bit. But at the root of all this, I think, is a real sense of almost resignation to the fact that we live in a unipolar world dominated by a single superpower. And I've been looking at newspapers from around the world, and it's extraordinary how they're all talking about this new American unilateralism. Le Monde, for example, if one analyzes American diplomacy since the September 11th attacks, it's obvious the United States has deliberately adopted a unilateral position on everything. It hasn't moved an inch on the Kyoto Protocol. It's not only maintained its position on biosecurity, but also vigorously fought against the Nairobi conference reforms. America has reaffirmed its opposition to the treaty on banning nuclear tests. In reality, this solitary conduct by the U.S. should not surprise us. It's a continuation of the policy adopted by President Bush. From the beginning, the September 11th attacks did not change America's position on dealing with world issues.
A sentiment not unique to Europe, I gather.
Absolutely not. In fact, one of the most interesting things I came across was the Russian language paper in Kazakhstan, Express, which says, after the tragedy of September the 11th, many Kazakhstanis came to view America in a different way, with love or even veneration. The desire to forgive America for all of its past sins has swept across the globe. But in fact, nothing has really changed in America's overseas priorities. Just as before, America fancies itself the master of everything under the sun and behaves accordingly.
And yet, when last we spoke, we were talking about the Kashmir issue, and you were quoting newspapers from around the world, from Germany to China, I believe, to the Middle East. mm-hmm. all in unison saying that only American influence can end the standoff and bring some resolution to the Kashmir conflict. It's striking, once again, the overwhelming ambivalence the world seems to feel about American unilateralism. Do they want it? Do they not want it?
Well, I think the lesson is that they want it when it's deemed to be useful or urgently necessary, but for the rest of the time, would America please leave the world alone a bit? I was very struck by the way in which the official Chinese newspapers, who really do speak for the Beijing government, are quite clear. From Xinhua, unilateralism is a concrete manifestation of America's pursuit of power politics throughout the world and goes against the main trend of dialogue and cooperation which the world would prefer. Even American allies in Asia are saying the same thing. From Asahi Shimbun of Tokyo, the world cannot move forward unless a fundamental change occurs in the behavior of this sole superpower, which considers international organizations and other states as mere tools for pursuing its own national interests. The ongoing stalemate over issues related to the Kyoto Protocol, the Test Ban Treaty, clearly indicate the need for America to change its approach towards the rest of the world. It would make a nice change if they even listened to us.
You know what it reminds me of, Martin? It reminds me of the Godfather. Don Corleone, feared, in some ways hated, but every time anyone needed a problem solved, they came and kissed his hand and, with respect, asked for his assistance. So am I out too far on a limb on this one?
No, because you'll find that some of the, particularly of conservative commentators around the world, agree with you. In Le Figaro, which is a conservative paper in France, it says, Europe has nobody to blame but itself for its being second-guessed by the Americans because of its own incompetence in the military sector. Afghanistan has simply summarized the new situation of European impotence. The Allies have the obligation to participate in missions as decided by the United States, following the guidelines determined by Washington. In each instance, rules are the same. At most, the Europeans have the right to information or to the impression that they've been kept informed. But in general, the European Union is absent. And, given its weakness, so it deserves to be.
All right. Martin, once again, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Martin Walker is Chief Correspondent for United Press International.
Over the last week, as plane loads of hooded and shackled detainees arrived in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the U.S. government faced charges by human rights groups that its treatment of prisoners violated humanitarian law under the Geneva Convention. In a press briefing, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made clear his belief that the convention did not apply in this case.
They will be handled in the right way. They'll be handled not as prisoners of war, because they're not, but as unlawful combatants. As I understand it, technically, unlawful combatants do not have any rights under the Geneva Convention.
While a few members of the U.S. media were allowed to view the arrival of the detainees from a distance, there are no images of the detainees in the media, either as they left Afghanistan or arrived in Cuba. The Pentagon has blocked photographers from transmitting photographs of the transport to news organizations. Oddly enough, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld looked to the Geneva Convention to justify the ban on pictures.
I've got a bunch of lawyers who are looking at all these treaties and conventions and everything, trying to figure out what's appropriate. The only thing I did notice that you can't take pictures of them. That's considered embarrassing for them, and they can't be interviewed, according to the Geneva Convention.
Here to help us decipher the Defense Department interpretation of the Geneva Convention is Michael Byers, professor of international law at Duke University. Professor Byers, welcome to On the Media.
I'm very glad to be here.
Okay, so it seems like the Pentagon is trying to have it both ways. Donald Rumsfeld says, for the purposes of their treatment, they are not prisoners of war.
Well, if you look at the convention, it says that if there's any doubt as to whether a detainee is a prisoner of war, they must be presumed to be a prisoner of war until it has been determined otherwise by a competent court or tribunal. Now, with all respect to the Secretary of Defense, he's not a court or tribunal.
But Donald Rumsfeld implicitly recognizes them as prisoners of war because he protects their rights under the Geneva Convention not to be photographed by the media. Is that a right under the Geneva Convention?
Well, Article 13 of the Convention says that prisoners of war must at all times be protected against insults and public curiosity. That's the provision that Mr. Rumsfeld is referring to. in denying access to the U.S. media. Now, the first point you've already made is that you can't really have it both ways. You can't say that they're prisoners of war when it comes to excluding the media, but they're not prisoners of war when it comes to their treatment. But the second point there is that this convention was negotiated back in 1949, and what they almost certainly meant with insults and public curiosity was the public parading of prisoners in front of jeering crowds. They were not thinking of a 24-hour media society where most people get their information from pictures.
To your knowledge, have the principles of the Geneva Convention ever been invoked to justify a limitation on press freedom?
Not that I know of. The best example of something like what you're referring to that I can think of goes back to those American pilots who were captured by the Iraqis during the Gulf War. They were paraded on Iraqi television and forced to make confessions on Iraqi television. Now that, to me, would count as a violation of Article 13 of the Geneva Convention. But the media in the United States, they're very capable of making responsible judgments. The decision not to broadcast the full videotapes of Osama bin Laden's statements was a decision that was made by the U.S. media at the recommendation of the White House, but not at the insistence of the White House. Now, I don't see why, in this instance, Donald Rumsfeld cannot trust the U.S. media to exercise that responsible discretion.
Michael Byers, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Michael Byers is a professor of international law at Duke University, and he spoke to us from Oxford University in England, where he is enjoying his sabbatical.
Coming up, an inside look at an inside look at movie making.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, and here are a few of your letters. 2 weeks ago, we had a largely angry email response to our piece on NPR's problems with the pro-Israel media monitoring group, CAMERA. Andrew L. Robinson of Bellevue, Washington, writes that he happens to agree that much of NPR's coverage seems biased in favor of the Palestinians. But independent of that, he writes, when they reported a comment from one listener that NPR is known as National Palestinian Radio, I was appalled to hear Ms. Gladstone and Mr. Garfield's flippant response of Oy gewollt and Oy weismir. That was condescending, to say the least, and only serves to reinforce the point made by the listener.
Martin Schneider of Taganic, New York, writes that, quote, we shook his respect for our show with that response. But Matt Warning of Seattle writes, as you said, oy vey, a pro-Palestinian bias, I often write to complain about the pro-Israel bias. And this from Giora Barr. As an Israeli living in the U.S., I find NPR the most inclusive, objective, and intelligent news source in the United States. I wonder if the ones who wrote those letters read the Israeli press. One of the things Israel can and should be proud of is its free media. Following almost daily the Israeli press, I can only imagine how the enthusiastic objectivity defenders would react if NPR were bold enough to voice only some of the concerns of many mainstream Israeli journalists who regularly criticize the policy of the government toward the Palestinians. Many of those journalists, by the way, are getting the same kind of responses. So your reporters are definitely in good company.
Please keep your letters coming in to On the Media at WNYC.org. And please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name and how to pronounce where you live. Ben Affleck and Matt Damon established themselves as big Hollywood stars in 1997 when they shared the Best Screenplay Oscar for Good Will Hunting. Dozens of movies and millions of dollars later, the lads and their producer partner Chris Moore decided that they should give a little back. Thus was born Project Greenlight, whereby an unknown director would compete for the chance to turn his script into a movie, and Matt, Ben, and Chris would turn the ordeal of making the movie into a documentary TV series. That documentary has been airing on HBO over the past few weeks, and viewers have learned to fear the bombastic executive producer Chris Moore, pity the overmatched producer Jeff Bayless, and loathe the devious line producer Pat Peach. Here, the devious one counsels the overmatched one.
I'm going to alert him about the beach. I'm going to alert him about the day myself.
I think it's pointless.
I know, but
I think that's pointless.
You call Chris Moore, you're going to cause a problem. If that you say there's a problem, Chris Moore wants to solve it.
It may not change.
He doesn't want to.
It's not going to change. What if it doesn't change? You've wasted your time.
Stirring up the pot unnecessarily. All I'm doing is wasting my time.
Naivete, thy name is Jeff.
Hello?
Jeff here.
How are you?
I'm not too good, Jeff.
We're not communicating well, man. And I was pretty let
down that you guys made a big decision to switch the whole weekend that you were going to shoot the beach at a different time without
anybody talking to me. So I've been sitting here trying to figure out how can I affect some change in this process. You know, this is
very hard for me to say what I'm about to say, but I want you to come back to L.A.
It's enough to make viewers glad they work in less backbiting professions, like, say, lion tamer, grifter, member of the Italian parliament. The movie we see made in Project Greenlight is called Stolen Summer, which premiered at Sundance this week. A star of Project Greenlight and the guileless producer of Stolen Summer, Jeff Bayless, joins me now, as does the executive producer of Stolen Summer and the heavy of Project Greenlight, Chris Moore. So, Chris, was Project Greenlight a true reflection of the process of movie making? Is this really how the sausage is made?
I think yes. I do think this is how sausage is made. I think having the camera on it maybe made it special kind of sausage, but I still think it's sausage. And, you know, a lot of the power struggles and the logistical struggles and the sort of who's in control and who gets to make decision struggles that you see on the show are exactly what happens, at least on the 10, 11 movies that I've produced. So either I really am a bad producer or that's sort of how it plays out.
And Jeff Bayless, what do you think?
It is sausage to some degree, though things did go a little bit more smoothly than you might see on the show.
How do you both feel you were portrayed in the series, Jeff?
Well, right now I think I look pretty incompetent, you know, like a moron pretty much. But, you know, I have been forced to kind of look at it as a character. And I realize that my character has an arc, and fortunately, I think I'm okay with the end result of the series. And
because right now in the series, you're pretty much Charlie Brown.
I'm the goat right now, definitely.
Chris, how do you think you were portrayed, and did you have any role in actually editing the series?
Well, unfortunately, yes, I did have a role in editing the series.
So you looking like a hard person.
Well, no, actually, Ben and Matt and I had made an agreement that we wouldn't comment on our own portrayal unless we thought it was absolutely false. So am I happy? I'm not happy. I'm embarrassed. But the truth of the matter is I'm more embarrassed by my behavior than I am by how I was portrayed. You know, I did lose my temper. I did get caught up in certain power struggles that I shouldn't have. And I did create drama that probably wasn't necessary. On the flip side, that first day I arrived on set, it was the most disorganized movie set I've ever been on. And that's embarrassing to me because I produced 10 movies and I know how to produce an organized movie set.
Well, at the premiere of the film at Sundance, Stolen Summer's director, Pete Jones, is quoted as saying, "Unfortunately, they decided to go with the reality TV version of what went on. It's all drama for TV." So, was it?
I unfortunately have a weird position, which is I'm a producer of all of the aspects of this project. So, you know, ProjectGreenlight.com, I also am a producer on. The show I was a producer on and the movie I'm a producer on. So I have a much more middle-of-the-road stance, which is certainly on the television show, we wanted to make a good television show. Certainly, we played with time, we played with interviews, we played with which obstacles Pete and the people making the movie had to overcome. But the set and sort of how it was running, all the things that happened did happen.
Well, let me ask you this. You, as executive producer, hired the production staff of Stolen Summer. Were the characters of Project Greenlight cast the same way the characters of the real world are cast? Were people picked in part because they were likely to cause or run into conflict? Did you stir the pot thinking, well, even if it's a lousy movie, at least we'll have a kick-ass TV show?
Absolutely not. Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, and I got into this because we wanted to find young filmmakers.
you know, I'm sad that this question is even being asked, but we certainly did not do anything to try and make the television show better. In fact, the people working on the TV show are arguing for more things next year because they were so upset with all the things we didn't do that would have made it a great television show.
What about line producer Pat Peach? I mean, by last Sunday's episode, he had clearly become the Iago of Project Greenlight, whispering and scheming and complaining. So far, it appears that he double-crossed Jeff into getting fired. Chris, did you watch the dailies on this thing? Did you see what he was doing?
No. We made one deal, Matt, Ben, and I, with the television show, which is we wouldn't give notes on our own portrayals, like as I said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The other note was I would not watch footage of it until the movie was finished shooting, so that none of my judgment, none of the things that I was going to do as producer on the movie would be affected or caused by what the documentary captured. So that I wasn't like calling Pat and saying, Pat, yesterday in dailies on the show, I saw you do this, right? We didn't want that to happen because then slowly and slowly, nobody was going to do anything in front of the documentary cameras, you know? The other thing is Pat hired all the crew. I didn't go to Chicago and hire anybody. And Pat certainly doesn't have any role in the television show. As you've pointed out, he's not coming across too well. I think the hard thing for Pat is he did that stuff. We didn't make that up. We didn't put that dialogue in there. He did it.
We're actually going to be speaking to Pat. Is there anything you want me to ask him?
I have a question.
Okay, Jeff.
Why?
Pat, why? Yeah.
Why what?
Why did you say that stuff if you knew the camera was rolling on you?
Well, before we get carried away here, you know, the movie and the television show are two completely different entities. As far as the television show, of course I knew that when I was hired, I would be portrayed as a silly TV villain. I mean, I knew Chris Moore's role was going to be the savior, and I knew Jeff Bayless's role would be the foil, and I knew that Pete Jones would be the guy that is cast as the upstart who, at the end of the day, hopefully learns something.
But did you know that that's how you would be cast?
Well, not exactly. You know, I'd asked Liz Bronstein, the executive producer, on the very first day I was hired. I said, come on, you know I'm going to be portrayed as the villain. She said, oh, no, 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 no. But, you know, when you put on the television cameras, it's a whole different thing. The magic of reality television happens in the editing room, everything about it. The whole portrayal is created and fabricated to look as though I'm snaking him behind his back and everything, which is not the truth.
Well, if you knew that at the beginning, really knew that, why did you participate?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't actually think that they would do anything that would go that far down the line, because it's a complete false portrayal. But I participated because it was a really exciting idea.
Do you really feel that you were portrayed falsely? Because you did say those things.
Well, the magic is all in the editing, with music and leaving out other sides of conversations and the lead-in. No one does not vent about their coworkers. They just don't have cameras on them.
Do you have any regrets?
I wish I'd have gone in a little bit stronger in terms of what my character was going to be on the TV series, because it would have been more fun for me. I was way too focused on making a good film, unlike, you know, I think some of the other people involved.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pat Peach was the line producer on the film Stolen Summer. Earlier, we heard from executive producer Chris Moore and co-producer Jeff Bayless. All three have starring roles in HBO's documentary series about making that movie called Project Greenlight.
A high school sophomore is the latest winner of a script writing contest sponsored by Scenarios USA, a nonprofit that turns teenagers' ideas into educational films. Mainly, they're designed to get kids to talk about sex. The idea is to get an authentic perspective by leaving the adults out of the conversation, because adults talking about teens talking about sex sound like idiots, as in this example from the 1950s.
A girl like Barbara should get to know her own limitations and someone should explain to her the difference between boys and girls in their reactions to sexual excitement.
Yes, yes, that ought to help. Oh, but don't you think her best bet is just to keep away from boys who want to pet?
The shorts produced by Scenarios USA about abortion, AIDS, violence, and teen pregnancy seem to sit well both with students and with schools because, according to Scenarios, 7 million students see the films each year. In the film by contest winner Janet Aponte called From an Objective Point of View, best friends make a pact not to have sex without first consulting one another. Reporter Jesse Graham was on the set.
Action. Shut up!
In a tiny Brooklyn brownstone bedroom, Janet Aponte stands squeezed behind camera equipment and bright lights. She leans against a wall plastered with pinups from Details magazine, watching two fully clothed teenagers kiss on an unmade bed. The boy reaches for a condom. The director gives the actors instructions.
And when you say the whoa, you have to go whoa, and you slide right away, just slide off her.
Okay.
Janet is 16 years old. She's watching professional actors breathe life into an idea that was born in her bedroom, in the apartment she shares with her mother and grandmother in Glendale, Queens. She still can't believe Hollywood directors are making her story into a movie.
It's really weird because my whole life I just imagined little things and put them on a computer or a notebook, and now they're actually coming to life in front of a camera, and it's very weird.
Lock it up.
Lock it up.
Roll sound.
Say shut up.
In Janet's film, when 16-year-old Rachel has a drunken encounter that ends in a pregnancy scare, she makes a pact with her best friend Kelly. The two girls promise they'll consult each other before having sex.
Wait, hold up, I forgot something. I'll meet you downstairs.
Okay.
But then, Rachel catches Kelly grabbing a condom on the way out of her house.
You're the one that's coming up with all the aggravation and everything, acting like you've never seen a condom.
Oh, I have seen one, but what I want to know is what you're going to use it for. Little Miss Purity, who had a pact with me, in agreement.
I'm sorry, okay? Maybe I changed my mind.
Kelly has a date to lose her virginity to her boyfriend, Trent. But her friend's challenge makes her rethink her choice. The result is a thoughtful look at teenage desire.
And action.
What was I thinking? Did I think I couldn't get pregnant or an STD? No. I got an A in biology. I know how all that works. Was I feeling peer pressure? Double no. I could care less what other people think about me. The fact was, I was horny. Trent was hot. I wanted to have sex, and that was all the reason I needed.
Take your time at the end, okay?
Okay.
Married filmmakers Jim McKay and Hannah Weir are volunteering their time to direct the film. McKay directed Our Song and Girls Town, two films that gave surprisingly raw and candid portraits of teenage girls. He says he was drawn to the Scenarios project by the non-judgmental and honest approach it brings to adolescent issues.
Well, you know, the more layers the story has and the less simplistic the story is, there's much more to talk about. So I think these are great, great starting points for kids who are viewing them to go further into these issues and say, well, I agree with this or don't agree with that.
The production site in a borrowed Brooklyn brownstone looks like any movie set. But each professional filmmaker on the set has a Forest Hills High School student working with them. Janet's friend Brittany Mendenhall helped with the sets. She says she's glad to see the actors are being filmed in typically messy bedrooms.
Like, when you watch a lot of shows, you can tell there's no teen input because the rooms are so clean, the bed's so neat. And I'm like, 95% of teenagers do not make their bed, so it's just unrealistic.
The film concludes with Kelly deciding not to have sex with Trent.
Pact or no pact, it's going to happen eventually. But when it happens, it's going to be when I'm ready. Maybe it'll be next year or next month. Or maybe even sooner.
18-year-old actor Melanie Diaz plays Kelly. She grew up on Manhattan's Lower East Side and says she appreciates being part of a project created by someone around her age.
I think that's why I like the script so much, is because Kelly, she's not saying sex is bad. She's like, yeah, I want to have sex, but I'm not ready. And it's not that sex is like this evil thing, you can't do it. It's just like, no, I know myself and I'm confident, and when I'm ready, I'm ready.
After 2 days of filming, Janet Aponte is getting ready to take a livery cab back to Queens. But first, she watches her actors push through their last take on a cold Brooklyn basketball court.
This last scene, the basketball court scene, it symbolizes how, even though Kelly decided at the end not to have sex, she's still here with her boyfriend. That relationship hasn't changed. She's still here with her best friend. That relationship hasn't changed. Nothing will change no matter what she decides to do, because
what she does behind her bedroom doors or her boyfriend's bedroom doors doesn't apply to the rest of the world.
Viewers may soon see Janet's film on networks like Showtime or MTV, where Scenario's projects have aired before. But mainly, it'll be seen in high school classrooms across the country starting next fall, where it will be used to start some difficult conversations.
Or maybe even sooner.
For On the Media, I'm Jesse Graham in New York.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by Irene Trudell, Dylan Keefe, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Andy Lancet, Allison Lichter, and Jim Colgan. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
And Bob, you'll know when you're ready.
I hope so.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.